Well, this guy probably doesn't need a lot of introduction for our channel, Jeff. You and I had a. How long ago was our talk?
Our original talk was back in March, I want to say. So maybe a few months ago.
So it was a few months ago. Okay.
Yeah.
And we just had the four-way conversation with Luke and Job, and you were I just finished a conversation with Jem and Mary. Those were the other two that I had on Slate today. So
experiment number two.
So it's been interesting. The amount of community that would develop around my channel was a complete surprise.
Yeah.
But other offline conversations going back and forth, I'll get an email from someone say, I'd like to talk to this person. And so I just send them the email so I don't have to disclose any email addresses. And then off it goes, or via Twitter in some cases. So it's really cool.
It's been great because we've just this past week, we've been having offline conversations, through the same, whatever this program is. where it's been me and Luke, and like Job reached out to me and he said, hey, I want to talk to you about a couple of things. And I was like, okay, cool, here's the time that I can do it. And we started talking, and right before we got on, he said, see if Luke can join. So he came on. So it was the three-way conversation without Paul this weekend. And earlier in the week, Julian was talking to Luke and saying, hey, let's me, you, and Jeff get on a call. So we've had a couple. Nick put a comment in one of your videos. He replied to a comment that Luke had put in there, and Luke's like, I really want to talk to that guy. So me and Nick and Luke talked yesterday.
Really?
It's been great. Yeah, it's awesome.
Have any of you recorded any of this?
We recorded one of them, but we've all decided we don't want it to get out.
Okay.
But it's mainly to share with a conversation partner that might not have been in on that one, because the question is always, well, what'd you guys talk about? And it's like, it's so free ranging and all over the place. And you've started taking notes. It's just really hard to condense and to be able to say, okay, we talked about this and this. It's crazy. So yeah, we did record, but we decided, for various reasons there were some private things disclosed. So we're like, probably not best to put that out there into the foreverness of the internet, I think is what I said on our four-way.
Yeah. So one of the ideas that I've been thinking about is I'm trying to think about how to, because it's growing and I don't want to get in the way. I don't want to become a bottleneck. And so I'm, actually we'll see what Peterson puts out in terms of his think spot, but I am thinking about what it would mean to have sort of a space where people could come, and it would be behind a paywall. Probably there'd probably be a subscription or something, and that I've had a real I don't want the thing to be about money, but to at least have a way of saying, if in a sense, when you, like you have in a real church, when you come in, you have some skin in the game. You're investing in this. And so I don't know. I'm thinking about how to facilitate better and where this can go and how I can use my time and all those kind of things. So, but
Joe made a funny comment today. We were DMing on Twitter, and I hope you don't mind me sharing this. he said he would like to have like a lobster con where we everybody could get together in person, and there could be specific subjects of topics and breakout sessions and all this kind of stuff. And I was like, I wouldn't be opposed to that idea. It's just, the travel that would be involved to get everybody together and, things like that. But who knows? Maybe something like that. Maybe somebody who's smarter than me, at least, can come up with a plan for putting something like that together.
Yeah, I've got a facility. my counsel's a soft touch for something like this. I've actually thought before that doing an event would be really cool, but I hadn't. Yeah, maybe that's something we should do, because I think having people this will get really crazy. So one of the things, so my wife is often, you know, she's just always dreaming of different things. So lately she's had this idea of, she's been just looking at hotels for sale in out of the way areas in Northern California.
Mm-hmm.
And we found one that was, you know, way up in the foothills someplace. Beautiful. So Northern California is dotted with these beautiful, basically abandoned gold mining towns that are semi-abandoned. There's still little communities living there, so on and so forth. But, you know, my wife's like, we should buy one of these hotels, because part of the idea is we have five kids, and so in the future it's going to be, how can the whole family come together? Well, actually, if we sort of had a hotel that we'd say, okay, we're going to do family, we're not going to rent out rooms in this space so everybody can come and we can have family time. But then it's like, well, we could have retreats and events and... because the real cool thing about an event like this would actually be the impromptu other conversations. And so a small hotel would actually be kind of the perfect venue for something like this.
Yeah.
Where people could come and stay for a couple of days and there'd be some planned events. And then there'd be, you know, so there'd be some put, ooh, this is good. This has got to happen.
Rando camp.
Rando camp. But, you know, and so people who have seen each other on the channel could come and, because, you know, and then have, you know, it's basically what I do in my meetups. We have like 2 hours of structured time. And then until I kick them out of the church because I can't stay up all night, then it's unstructured time. And just here at the church, then people, there might be little clumps of two or three or four that are having a conversation, and it's really meaningful. So I think Joe's onto something.
He's an idea machine.
Maybe I ought to do one in the Netherlands. Maybe I've never been to the Netherlands. I'm sure he wouldn't have, but I think finding I would think like a small hotel in a rather isolated place could be a really cool space for something like that, because it's more like a retreat setting than, because if you're all, say, using the church during the day, but then go to different hotels,
yeah,
you want a kind of space that can facilitate. So,
yeah.
Ooh, this is a good idea.
That's interesting. Let me noodle on that a little bit more.
Yeah. Well, we're putting it out here. I mean, it'll percolate.
Oh, so. Yeah, that's right. What do you call it? Not the hive mind, but the crowdsourcing.
Yes, yes.
There we go. It's out there. Yeah, I talked about in our four-way conversation how we felt like you don't talk enough on our conversation videos, and so I wanna give you more agency. And I don't know that this is. I know that people have like sent you their topics list before, but I want to share my screen and just give you a menu of topics.
Okay.
And I know I just said I want to give you more agency, but there's one on here that I really want to make sure that we get to, because it's another asking for a friend kind of thing.
Okay. Okay.
So let me see if I can share this screen.
Okay.
There you go. So, reflections on my conversion, liberalism in the church, calling yourself a Christian, or why one can't bring oneself to identify as a Christian, or who do we dare say is or is not a Christian, salience, meaning, or what moves us in art, literature, drama, or even just in life, Christians and politics. I feel like I'm a host of Jeopardy. When Peterson sounds like or compliments Lewis, our existence is an ever-continuing series of training for the next level. Hmm. Q&A with Job, or when Job puts you on the spot. How we conceptualize those we love who have died. How do we know when God speaks? And stories and the story verse, Lewis, L'Engle, and Lucas, or rather, Star Wars.
Yeah. They're all good. You know, it's interesting because Job's a cagey dude.
He is.
Job not only Job has infiltrated one of my smaller private networks, which is a little listserv called CRC Voices.
Oh, he got me to sign into it.
Oh, have you signed in? But you haven't posted yet.
I haven't posted anything, but I'm following, and it's quite interesting.
It's quite interesting.
I can see how it can get quite explosive if people aren't careful.
Yes. Well, that's been a listserv that's been around for about 30 years. And some of the people on it have been there the whole time. And it's a pretty small group right now. But it's it was so fascinating when Job jumped in, because of course Vendonk jumped in first. He joined a few years ago before I started this. And then of course when Job visited Southern California, he cooked up with Vendonk, who of course was a Dutch immigrant, and then Job joined CRC Voices, and that just thrilled all the old timers there, because it's like, you know, because they've all known what I've been doing, and some are appreciative and some are skeptical, but it's been fascinating. So if anybody wants to jump into CRC Voices, they'll find an interesting community.
Well, I think we found the first topic that interests you, and by good fortune, there's not a whole lot of content there, but there are a couple of things that I'd like to cover, and it revolves around when I got to meet Job for lunch down in Austin back in May. So give me just a second. Let me pull up my notes on that.
Wow, you not even have topics? You have sub notes on topics?
I have topics, and then I have my notes to kind of keep me on task.
Wow.
I'm also a process thinker, and I won't even get to the point. Sorry, give me one second. I thought I had it pulled up, but I don't.
No problem.
Where is it? This is one of the things that's endearing about your channel, Paul, is whenever you're doing something like this, you rarely ever hit pause. We just kind of sit there and and wait.
Yeah, there's plenty of dead air. Everybody speeds up. A lot of people speed up listening to me, which I know. And I've started doing that to a bunch of other people. And because you can listen at 1.25 or 1.5 or even 2.0 sometimes and pick it up.
Yeah, if you get tired, just fast forward. Okay, I found it. So the setup for this is, I remember whenever I was meeting with Job, we got to talking about, one of his conversations with you. And I said, oh, I just loved it. When you were direct with Paul and you asked him, tell me, Paul, what is God to you? Mm. And I was thinking, oh man, it's really neat seeing Paul under the gun and seeing a pastor have to answer this question and really have to answer it without, you know, giving what the writer words, you know, I love you more than anything in the world type thing that you're talking about in your other video. And so I was like, yeah, I really like that. And then right away, I'm in Job's crosshairs and he asks me, Jeff, what is God to you? I'm like, oh. This isn't as fun when I'm the one that has to answer the question.
At the meetup Job went to in Southern California in Vendonk's, like John Vendonk lives in a trailer park. There's a community house in that trailer park. Uh-huh. And because John's usual meetup has 4 to 6 people, and when I was there, we had about 15, John was trying to think, well, how can we facilitate this? And so he had people ask me short questions, and I only had 2 minutes to answer, which was a good exercise because it forced me to focus, which is opposite of what YouTube usually does to me. So that was actually really good. And a lot of people have said I should do some question and answer videos, but I'm thinking about it, but I want to do it in a way that actually forces me to focus. Some guy called me out of the blue. I don't know who he is. But he called and he asked me permission to, can I take stuff from your channel and make sound bites out of them and other videos out of the bites? I said, sure, go ahead. I'm kind of curious. He's got to send me a link if he does, because I really want to know what he puts together. But
yeah,
I'm not afraid.
That's wild. Okay, so just to recap, For anybody that hadn't watched that conversation between you and Job, he basically asked you, Paul, what's God to you, or who, or how does that work? I think is what he said. And you said, God is everything, but that's not quite right, because he isn't everything, because there's a lot of stuff that isn't God, because it isn't good. And so that was your answer. I thought that was a really good answer. When he asked me the same question, I said, anytime I've ever felt the deepest possible sense of love from another person, from my children, from my spouse, from a family member, from a friend, to me, that is God. Hmm. And then I was like, oh, I feel really good about that answer. And then he asked the follow-up. He said, what's God not to you? So I said, oh man, that's a harder question.
It is.
And so I said, somewhere in the New Testament, I think in one of the books of John, not John's gospel, but one of John's letters, there's a passage that references Jesus. And I think that John says something akin to, in him there was no darkness, only light. But in my very laborious interaction now with the Old Testament, which, just a reminder to everybody, I'm the one that's handwriting the Bible, and I'm in Joshua chapter 7 as of today. In my interaction with the Old Testament, there are some things in there that God does that look an awful lot like what we'd call darkness. And in some instances, it appears as if he takes pleasure in dealing death to people.
Yes.
So it is hard for me to say with full confidence that I know what God is not.
Mm.
And that's the best answer that I could give him.
Mm. Those passages are there.
Yeah.
And
Jesus doesn't shy away from calling the Old Testament God his Father.
No.
You know?
No.
I am that God. That's what he says, the God of the Old Testament.
That's right. And Jesus knew those passages.
Yeah.
I mean, Jesus is almost continually quoting what we call the Old Testament.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. There is, God is not the kind of being you want as your enemy. And he makes that abundantly clear.
Yeah. So it reminded that tweet where Jonathan Peugeot replied to your Peterson Bishop Barron video.
Yep.
On Twitter.
Yep.
And then Jess, who's been on a couple times on your
yep.
channel.
Yep.
You know, he came in and started talking about it. And I've had that thought too. That was another topic that I wanted to put on here. So maybe this leads into it, but I've never been satisfied with any of the theological answers I've been exposed to so far. And that's not to say there aren't really good ones, and I just haven't. There probably are really good ones, and I just haven't come across them yet. As to explaining the wrath of God, I've heard, like, Tim Mackey over at the Bible Project on his podcast, you know, he gave a pretty good one where he said, you know, sometimes it's just your wrath is you hate this thing so much that's destroying your precious creation. And that's what the wrath is. But it seems like the wrath is actually taken out on that precious possession. And, you know, 15-year ago version of me would say, Jeff, have you just read a ton of George MacDonald? Don't you understand this a little bit better? And so that I'm doing a deep dive now, first into Lewis again, and some of these topics, warning, I'm going to be quoting a lot of Lewis. Like, you know, I loved it when you spent most of your video reading out of The Problem of Pain. That was awesome. but that wrath of God one is one that's hard to wrap my head around. And at the same time, it is ultimately nonsensical for me to say that God is ultimately wrath. that God has evil, because at that point, you know, it's not that. Your model or your frame where you talked about, when you were talking about, is Tolkien in Middle Earth? Well, here's Tolkien's house. Is his house, you know, where does he live? And that was really helpful. And it's really helpful to think of God in that way with this. God is not evil. God certainly uses evil for his purposes. He thwarts evil. He confounds it. He turns it for good. He's not scared to use it. He's not scared. He uses it, I think, ultimately against itself, if you look at the resurrection or the crucifixion and resurrection. But I think you could say the same as Sauron is in Tolkien. Evil is in God, in the sense that evil is in the mind or the imagination of God as a possibility and an eventuality, with the agency that we have been given. And I know that's a very simple, that, you know, that's shallow level theology, but that's the only way that I can make sense of it. You know, it's too easy for me to say the things in the Old Testament, well, that's not God. You know, they misunderstand. Actually, there could be things that are misunderstandings, or it's a way of viewing the world that just does not compute with our modernist frame.
Yeah.
So I'm open to that. But just outright saying, no, God was not even involved in that at all. That's too easy for me. That doesn't seem like reality to me.
Yeah. Oh, this is hard stuff. And I think part of what, you know, the Old Testament also has a tradition of David, Job saying, these things are beyond me. And that can sound like a cop out. But we regularly have the experience. So one of my daughters, so they come home from college, and one of the things that usually happens when they come home from college is they start watching some junk TV. And so one of my daughters is watching Gossip Girl that I know nothing about. And so suddenly I'm watching and I'm looking, and they're all using flip phones. And it's like, well, how old is this show? And well, this show was out in the mid-aughts or something before the iPhone came out. And there's a few Blackberries rolling around. So I'm watching this. And here's a young man who's had, I mean, it's just a soap opera, the whole show. And so this young man is in Paris, and he bumps into this girl, and they were both trying to get away from each other, and they just bump into each other on the street of Paris. And the girl says to her friend, I know, it's just some scheme that he has. And, you know, from the 3 minutes I was in the room, it was quite obvious it was no scheme that he had. But we are so prone to... We are so prone to imagine we know more than we do. And these questions about God and evil are so, so difficult. Because you know, it's one thing, you know, I use this illustration a lot. My 3-year-old that's getting a vaccination, who looks up at me, who with every bone in his body imagines that nurse coming in, giving him the shot has to be evil. Who else is going to come into a room with a big needle and plunge it into his arm and then looks up at me and I'm letting it happen? Yeah. Where's the evil in that story? But the Bible is very clear that God is, you know, this gets into what we're, the same conversation we're having on Twitter. You know, chaos. And one of the things that I think I can't for the life of me think about my years in seminary, any significant time of discussion
a theological conversation or instruction on chaos. It was like the category didn't exist.
Yeah.
But if you, it seems so clearly there, but we just can't conceptualize it. What is chaos? Chaos is disorder. And this gets into reflections I have sometimes about the life of the age to come. And so in the new visions of the New Jerusalem in the book of Revelation, you have this sea of crystal, or there's no longer any sea. And obviously sea is a symbolic representation of chaos. And I think, will there be no chaos in the new creation? What does that mean? Will we be bored with it? Will we,
we don't have categories for it. I don't think
we really don't. And so I understand why, I can understand why we have trust issues being so small. My current dog is a rescue dog, and he's a very small dog. And this dog has, I think the dog belonged to a family with small children, and don't give small children a small dog. Give small children a big dog. When my kids were little, we had Rottweilers, and those kids climbed on those dogs, and those kids did everything to those dogs. Those dogs didn't care. They were bulletproof, and they knew it. And so they just indulged the children. But a little dog, a child can actually harm. And so My little dog has huge trust issues. And I think we're like that little dog. We just have so many trust issues by getting beat up by this world. And that to me is the story of, it's something that in all Peterson's treatment of Genesis, when I read about Jacob, or when I read about Abraham and Jacob and Joseph's brothers, you know, it's the trust issues are just massive, and it ruins us. So
yeah,
those are such hard questions, you know, and you read the book of Job, you know, Job's namesake, read the book of Job, and, you know, God says to, you know, Hasatan, the accuser. So what you been doing? Traveling to and fro.
Yeah.
You know, and the good are only good because it pays them. Well, have you considered my servant Job? And it's like, consider somebody else, please. and go ahead and have your way with him. And it's like, you think about, you know, the book of Job is in some ways sort of like that Eddie Murphy.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking.
Trading places. And, you know, when Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy learned that the two old geezers had a $1 bet by destroying, what is it, Wilfred or something, by destroying his life and elevating the other, you know, all they want to do is wreak havoc on these players. But, and this, the most, I think the truest but most offensive thing to us is, in fact, the idea that God has every right to play with us if he wants to. This is an idea that the ancients had that we in modernity just rebel against.
Oh, yeah. It's unfathomable to us.
Yeah. God has no right. Really? What is the, and the Bible, you know, what does the pot have to say to the potter?
No, I have the right to me, and that's it. And then if you ask me, well, where do you get that right from? Well, it just derives from me. You know, it's obvious. Isn't it obvious?
And I watch parents with little kids, and I watch that 2-year-old, you know, in their own 2-year-old way, protest, you know, with every bit of passion, far more than an adult can master. And the wise parent watches and, all right, have your temper tantrum. You go ahead, hold your breath. Hold it till you turn blue and pass out. Peterson talks about that in one of his videos.
Yeah.
You know, a kid who, and Peterson's just sitting there, wow, this kid has some will. It takes a lot to hold your breath until you pass out. And it doesn't scare him. And I think that's the way God is with us. And we're like, you know, okay, God, you show up. All right, I will.
Yeah.
And of course, in the book of Job, God shows up and Job puts his hand over his mouth, because when God shows up, he begins to realize, oh, I'm totally outmatched in every way. And so
there's nothing I can do that he can't handle.
Right. So the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And we don't like it. We are what we are. My little dog is what it is. And my dog is the product of, you know, generations of breeding that probably should be illegal, because we wanted a little face on a little animal and a little short nose and all those little cute things, and just inbred the thing to death. And so now my tiny little dog has trust issues.
Makes sense. All right, that was topic one.
That was
25 minutes.
My videos are so long.
We'll see if we can get this next one done and then shut it down.
Okay.
Because I don't want to keep you long. I don't know if you have anybody after you. I would assume you.
I've got a 7 o'clock class, so I need a couple hours to break in between.
Okay, so I'll try not to be long winded. That's a tall order. Okay, next one. This is the one I want to do. Calling yourself a Christian, or why one can't bring oneself to identify as Christian, or who do we dare say is or is not a Christian? So I'm just going to go through a couple of questions and points. These are more rhetorical, and then I'm going to bring Lewis into the conversation.
Okay.
Okay. When can someone call themselves a Christian? There's an idea that I'll get into in a bit about unintentional Christians or unaware Christians, or Lewis used the phrase secretly influenced Christians. What does it mean to be a Christian? Can someone be a Christian without ever knowing it? This side of the grave. Maybe I'll tack that onto the end of it. Is it possible for Christ to flow through non-Christians and for them to participate with Christ without knowing it as participation with Christ? Can Christ know someone, and I mean fully know them, both their elephant and their rider, without someone who is only in their head and in their rider knowing Christ? So only knowing in a rider sense versus an elephant sense. Can Christ, the more important question to me is, can Christ know them fully without them knowing Christ in the headway? So those are some primer questions. All right. Here's C.S. Lewis in my read through of everything that I have. I came across this in God in the Dock. He's answering questions for some factory workers. I think it's around 1944. Quick little trivia. It's apparently in the factory that made equipment used in the music studio where the Beatles recorded Abbey Road. I haven't confirmed this, but I read that somewhere when I was researching this particular Q&A session that he was doing. It's called Answers to Questions on Christianity. He got a question: will you please say how you would define a practicing Christian? Are there any other varieties besides a practicing one? Lewis says, certainly there are a great many other varieties. It depends, of course, on what you mean by practicing Christian. If you mean one who has practiced Christianity in every respect, at every moment of his life, then there is only one on record, Christ himself. That sounds familiar. In that sense, there are no practicing Christians, but only Christians who, in varying degrees, try to practice it and fail in varying degrees and then start again. A perfect practice of Christianity would, of course, consist in a perfect imitation of the life of Christ. I mean, insofar as it is applicable in one's own particular circumstances, not in an idiotic sense. It doesn't mean that every Christian should grow a beard or be a bachelor or become a traveling preacher. It means that every single act and feeling, every experience, whether pleasant or unpleasant, must be referred to God. It means looking at everything, chaos and order, everything as something that comes from him, and always looking to him and asking his will first and saying, how would he wish me to deal with this? So there's some Lewis fun. And then I'm adding this part in, is intentionally cooperating with God in action while remaining agnostic about the physical resurrection or not being able to accept the physical resurrection due to the lenses built into you by your culture, your family, your ancestors, your environment, and all. Good enough. Good enough for what? Good enough for God? What is good enough for God? What is acceptable to God? And then here's where I go next, so bear with me. I want to read you a blog post that I did 15 years ago when I was reading Lewis, and I was really struggling with a lot of this. So this is an excerpt from Mere Christianity, and this is what Job said, the blog post that I read to him when we were down in Austin, and he referenced it in our four-way conversation. Lewis says, the world does not consist of 100% Christians and 100% non-Christians. There are people, a great many of them, who are slowly ceasing to be Christians, but who still call themselves by that name. Some of them are clergymen. There are other people who are slowly becoming Christians, though they do not yet call themselves so. There are people who do not accept the full Christian doctrine about Christ, but who are so strongly attracted by him that they are his in a much deeper sense than they themselves understand. There are people in other religions who are being led by God's secret influence to concentrate on those parts of their religion which are in agreement with Christianity, and who thus belong to Christ without knowing it. For example, a Buddhist of goodwill may be led to concentrate more and more on the Buddhist teaching about mercy and to leave in the background, though he might still say he believed, the Buddhist teaching on certain other points. Many of the good pagans, and maybe he's thinking of Plato here, long before Christ's birth, may have been in this position. And always, of course, there are a great many people who are just confused in mind and have a lot of inconsistent beliefs, all jumbled up together. So I would say a little over 15 and a half years ago, this isn't Lewis, this is me now. I was questioning a lot of beliefs that I had. I wasn't questioning my faith in God or that there was a God or even that Christ is who the Gospels say he said he was. I was, however, struggling with church, with pastors' sermons, with strenuous arguments about what the speaker considered, quote, essential Christian doctrine. I was hearing blatant contradictions between pastors of the same denominations. There weren't contradictions about who Christ was or the nature of God. The contradictions were far from what even I considered essential topics of discussion, and I was a mere layman. That's one of the reasons why when one pastor in particular claimed, without any doubt, that one specific view on what he called the end times was, quote, clearly stated in the Bible, I was thrown for a loop. If it is not an essential doctrine, I thought, why not just say this is a particular view that different Christians have differed on for a long time and still do, instead of glibly saying that it is clearly spelled out in Scripture. I let that get to me. I stopped going to church and I took a little spiritual vacation. It was time to kick back and relax from all the stress. Now, what I call a vacation was actually me foregoing any concern for the spiritual aspects of my life. During this time, I still had an interest in finding out some different Christian viewpoints than the ones I'd been raised in, but I was not interested in just throwing myself back into a church still saddled with the questions and frustrations that had developed in me. When visiting a friend out of town, he gave me the book, A New Kind of Christian, by Brian D. McLaren. Some of the things in there pissed me off, and some of the things in the book scared me. As I kept reading, I could feel the parts of me that were taught to think a certain way about Christianity and the practice of it through what I knew about church screaming out in protest. On my flight home from the visit, I came across a passage in the book which brought me to tears. And there I sat, alone on my row, flying from Minneapolis to Dallas, sobbing. I couldn't understand why it impacted me the way it did, so I didn't feel like I knew how to even express it if I were to talk to anybody about it. I think I better understand now why it hit me the way it did. And I've since misplaced the McLaren book, but by good fortune, the passage that was actually hitting me was quoting from another author, C.S. Lewis. Hmm. Surprised? Hmm. The quote was from the final installment of The Chronicles of Narnia, The Last Battle. And towards the end of the story, Aslan, the Christ figure in the Chronicles, is welcoming some of the main characters of the series into the afterlife, into his country, into heaven. An unlikely character named Emoth turns up in Aslan's heaven. Unlikely, it seems, because he spent his life earnestly following and serving a false god in the story named Tash. Here's a passage from The Last Battle, which I do have in my possession, where Emoth comes to the undeniable realization that Tash is a false god because he is personally greeted by Aslan. And here, Paul, I know you know this story, but I just want to share this excerpt with everybody. Emoth, recounting his story, he says, "But the glorious one," talking about Aslan, "bent down his golden head and touched my forehead with his tongue, and he said, 'Son, thou art welcome.' But I said, 'Alas, Lord, I am no son of thine, but the servant of Tash.' He answered, 'Child, all the service thou hast done to Tash, I account as service done to me. Then by reason of my great desire for wisdom and understanding, I overcame my fear and questioned the glorious one and said, Lord, is it then true, as the ape said, that thou and Tash are one? The lion growled so that the earth shook, but his wrath was not against me. And he said, it is false, not because he and I are one, but because we are opposites. I take to me the services which thou hast done for him, for I and he are of such different kinds that no service which is vile can be done to me, and none which is not vile can be done to him. Therefore, if any man swear by Tash and keep his oath, for the oath's sake, it is by me that he has truly sworn, though he know it not. And it is I who reward him. And if any man do a cruelty in my name, then though he says the name Aslan, it is Tash whom he serves, and by Tash his deed is accepted. Dost thou understand, child? I said, Lord, thou knowest how much I understand. But I said also, for the truth constrained me, yet I have been seeking Tash all my days. Beloved, said the glorious one, unless thy desire had been for me, thou wouldst not have sought so long and so truly. For all find what they truly seek." The reason that this excerpt pierced me the way it did is because it presented God the way I had always hoped, deep in my heart, he would be. And yes, I know it's just a story, but the character I recognized in the story was the same person, capital P, I recognized as the ruler of my heart. As poor and disobedient a subject as I am, this, I think, is the first time I personally experienced what Tolkien calls a eucatastrophe. He defines it as, quote, "the sudden happy turn in a story which pierces you with a joy that brings tears." He goes on to explain that a eucatastrophe has the effect it does because it, quote, "is a sudden glimpse of truth," and, quote, "it perceives that this is indeed how things really do work in the great world, capital G, capital W, for which our nature is made." I felt overjoyed at the possibility that this is how God practices his judgment with non-Christians. It added a level of fairness and justice to the whole Christian idea relating to those that are not confessed believers in Christ. I like the idea of a secret influence, God's influence, that was echoed in this Lewis passage. It satisfies my longing for an expectation of justice that I know is in the character of the God I serve. We out of time yet?
I don't know how I'm going to top this answer.
I think built into the Christian idea of God is at heart the belief that in the end, God will do what's right. Based on the kind of creature I know myself to be, the kind of creature I know human beings know themselves to be, there's no possible way we can stand in judgment over that other being. And so I do believe that in the end, God will do what's right. And because of who I know myself to be, God will do what the right that God will do likely does not align perfectly with what I imagine to be right. And so, you know, in a lot of the sentences that you gave me, can someone be a Christian without knowing it? Can Christ flow through a non-Christian, someone knowing that that's Christ flowing through them? Part of the reason I maintain myself as a Calvinist, as you know, whether that label is, and I use that label, it's probably not a great label because people understand it to be so many different things.
It's a triggering label.
Yeah, it's a triggering label. But I think the thesis statement for the Bible can be found in the book of Jonah, which says salvation is of the Lord. Mm. That finally, all of the questions that I see bother people often. Now, as a pastor in a conservative, what I consider on the spectrum, a fairly conservative denomination, which the Christian Reformed Church is, which has been shaped by the dominant representation of Christianity that tends to send all the energy to focus on this question about eternal destination, inclusion into the age to come, exclusion from the presence of Christ for eternity, all of those knotty questions. And I, on one hand, do not want to diminish or avoid those questions. Lewis doesn't at all. Lewis is very much an evangelical in this way, in that, oh, we have a visitor.
Huh. Hello.
He's like, oh, I didn't plan on anybody being there. I guess I didn't lock the room because I thought there might be a few of us. I better lock the poor guy. I think I'll probably talk to him tomorrow.
Oh. He's just checking the link, I guess.
Just checking the link. He got the link. It's like, oh, I gotta check this out. Uh-oh, there's people in the room. But, you know, Lewis was very much an evangelical. Lewis was, and many of those, and this is so funny, given a bunch of his other ideas were very far from what Americans would consider proper evangelical theology today.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's true, but the heart of who he was in terms of at every moment, a little bit of us is either turned towards heaven or turned away. All of these ideas, he's very evangelical in that. His vision is very much on life of the age to come and the further up and further in that will go. Yet at the same time, and I think this is right, he saw that this is, you know, these decisions about the next chapter in our story are not ours. That, see, this is so hard because in one hand, it is perfect freedom. These are our decisions and the choices that we make in this world every day are consequential for the life of the age to come. That is true. But I just trust that however God manages whatever sorting has to be done, that God will get it absolutely right, certainly far beyond any critique I could manage or defend. So, you know, one of the blog posts I wrote early on my blog back in 2007 on heaven and parties, you know, I took Lewis's, so I took Lewis's perspective, which is sort of mirrored by Dallas Willard. I heard this somewhere. It's not in writing, but at a conference or something, someone once asked Dallas Willard, you know, who goes to heaven? And Dallas Willard answered, anyone who can stand it. And I think that's a great answer, because on one hand, you know, Lewis's perspective is correct in that he has in that the door to hell is locked from the inside. I think that's true. On the other hand, also from Jesus' images of locked doors and outer darkness and gnashing of teeth, we also have the sense that God will not allow refugees from the age of decay to be bothered by those who wish to continue it, and that those who seek the bosom of Abraham, like Lazarus, will no longer be tasked to run errands for lesser men in hotter places in Hades from that story. And so part of the challenge that we have with any attempt to penetrate the future history beyond the consummation, we simply lack ability, knowledge, categories, and most of the images we have from Scripture are teasers and gifts of God that are meant for our comfort and our warning. And so this is, we are all toddlers when it comes to this. And we must respect our toddlerhood in this. And that means showing great mercy and deference to the toddlerhoods of others, both on the side of perhaps overly generous or on the side of overly stingy. So, you know, how can we do better than what we have from the Scriptures? And finally, we get the admonition that is in The Horse and His Boy, where, you know, which is the admonition that Jesus gives to Peter when he asks about John. Whatever I decide to do for him, that's between me and him. You must follow me. And that's, so in a sense, we are all individuals in that, where, we're going to decide. So many of these questions so quickly lead us to judge God, which is the stupidest thing we can imagine a human being to do. That we are going to stand in judgment over God. It is utter folly.
It doesn't even make sense from the, just looking at it from the psychological significance sermons, right, as Barron called them.
Yes, he called them sermons.
Yeah.
Sermons.
Yeah.
Wow.
His sermons, like yours.
Yes.
It doesn't even make sense from that perspective, because if you think about the concept of God as the top of the hierarchy by which the standard by which everything else is judged, if you're finding something in your head about, aha, what about this? You're, by the way, I just pointed up, aha, what about this? It's the top of the hierarchy. So it's nonsense to say there's something that I can think of, if I'm not at the top of the hierarchy, that is more just than what's at the top.
Yeah.
And when you talked about Dallas Willard saying, whoever can stand it, an image that popped into my head was that the path to get to heaven is lined one by one in order by the people that you the types of people you hate the most and can't stand, and specifically the people that you know that you never ever want to be around. Yeah. And you have to go one by one through that stack of people. Yeah. Not until you can stand them, but until you actually love them and care for them and want what is best for them.
Yeah.
And yeah, if that's what heaven is, it's only for people who can stand it. And I know, I'm not so sure I want to stand heaven right now.
The radical humility that heaven requires, Yeah, we know so little, and none of what I'm saying, you know, is meant to undermine, you know, any of what, say, the Heidelberg Catechism talks about in terms of fruit that leads to, you know, the fruit of Christ. I was just talking to Jem again, and we'll probably share this next video that we did today, because we had a private part and then a public part, and which isn't uncommon with people. But, you know, there's so much more. I have so much more hope for those who come to Christ and say, I have some who Christ to say come to Christ and say, I have so little imagination that you could accept me into your kingdom. That's the functional equivalent of Lord have mercy on me, which is the surest path to hell is to bank on our own righteousness. Why would we do that? Bank on his, because my righteousness is full of self-righteousness and self-seeking motivations, and I'm just trying to puff myself up. And part of what's so interesting about some of Lewis's vision of this is that, in a sense, you know, I read there's a Christian Smith, I think I might have it down here. Christian Smith has a textbook on world religions. And I remember his introduction to Hinduism basically says, you know, Hinduism basically says everybody gets what they want. I thought, well, that's interesting. And Lewis's vision of the afterlife is sort of like that, except that, as Lewis says, we want mud pies in the backyard when a day at the beach is in the offering. Yeah. So we desire too little. And I take that admonition seriously. And so one of the things that I continue to have to grow in is to ask God for bigger things, because I'm too chicken. Because how would I dare ask God for, and there's some sermon illustrations like this too that are out there, I know, but why would I dare ask God for small things? You know, it's the parable of the talents. It's the dude that says, well, I knew you were a harsh man, so I just kind of played it safe. Yeah, that doesn't go well in that parable. It's the people that risk it all. And this is why, you know, this is why I do believe that all of the stories in the Bible about a great inversion are going to be absolutely true. That there will be people, you know, there will be people that we see in the age to come that will be utter surprises. And as Lewis has in The Great Divorce, you know, the center of a parade in you know, the other side of the bus ride is a woman that nobody ever would have imagined. And I know that to be true, because I regularly see saints that this world will not know. Mm-hmm. And I think, yeah, if there is anything like justice in the universe, these people will receive far more than many of us who perhaps have our names on YouTube and YouTube followings and the like. So, you know, that's God. If God is what Christianity says he is, he is going to do more and better than we can hope or imagine in all of these areas. And to me, that is just such a, that is a thought that fills me with joy and courage and satisfaction. And that's a good thing.
Yeah. So. Well, you got one more in you?
No.
Oh, come on.
Okay, a little one.
It shouldn't be long. You get to control it, because this is really just a question for you.
Okay.
So this was my asking for a friend. This is the liberalism in the church one.
Yeah.
And you made a comment on one of your videos where you said, liberalism, something like this, liberalism is an attempt to preserve the church as an institution. Is that sound familiar?
Yes.
Okay. And
historic classical liberalism in terms of theological liberalism. You have to be careful with that because liberalism means so many different things in so many different contexts.
Okay. So before you give your answer, I just wanted to add a little bit of context. So I know of a nun, N-O-N-E, who says, yeah, I believe in God, but I don't think I can or I don't want to call myself a Christian because a lot of views held by most Christians don't line up with my personal views, like abortion rights or gay rights. I'm for these things, and most churches seem to hold the opposite view. And so I was just wondering, you know, how you might answer that person who says that, and then also, you know, if you have time or however much time you want to spend expounding on that idea of liberalism, or what was the term you used?
Theological liberalism.
Theological liberalism being an attempt to preserve the church as an institution or being missional, basically.
Well, and a lot of that theological liberalism is in the 19th and early 20th century, really. I think some of what would be in what we might call liberal churches today would be what I call progressive liberationism. And one has sort of taken off from the other. Now, first of all, I want nothing that I'm going to say now to take away from the previous conversation we just had. Because we're now dealing with things below, in a sense.
Yeah.
I completely understand a person today who has been formed by the culture today looking around and saying, why on earth could a church not express the kind of liberation and generosity we have seen expressed to people via, well, this is going to get me in trouble, via abortion or, you know, LGBT rights. I can totally, completely understand where they're coming from and understand why they would see these things as good. I get that. I also can understand, I'm just going to get in trouble with both sides now. I can also understand how you have these stories. One kind of book that I enjoy reading are some of these slave biographies that come out of the middle of the 19th century. 12 Years a Slave. They made a movie of it, but I didn't see the movie, but I read the book and I found the book to be powerful. And you know, Frederick Douglass, as he's imagined now, read Frederick Douglass himself. And actually read the words of these slaves, many of these slaves became deeply Christian people. And they became deeply Christian people via, this is crazy, via those people who bought them as property and on one hand enslaved them and, in the words of Abraham Lincoln, you know, derived their bread from the sweat of other men's brows and went to church on Sunday and couldn't imagine how the North was going to deprive them of their property. I mean, look, read. Go back and don't just imagine what that struggle was about. Go back and read the documents. And about, you know, who people in their own words in the 19th century, slaves, slave owners, abolitionists. I just, over last summer, I read a terrific biography about John Brown. Fascinating man, fascinating story. All of us are contextual. And if the previous conversation we just had has any meaning at all, it has to include all that contextuality. And that doesn't mean that the decisions we have to make with respect to the hot topics of today are irrelevant or relative, but they're all contextualized. And again, if we imagine the greatness of God, all of this is math that he can do. And so where I think churches go off the rails, you know, when we think about you know, so there's a lot of conversations about orthodoxy. One of the points that I made in one video was the Orthodox Church lost the East to Islam, and then they had to endure Islam. And then the church in the East had to endure communism. They lost, you know, the Russian church lost Russia to communism, and they endured it. And so it's both a realization of their flaws and a realization of their endurance. I'm reading a book right now on the Protestant Reformation. There were horrible things that were going on in the medieval Roman Catholic Church. I mean, corruption was incredible, and the Protestant Reformation never would have happened if the church had not been that corrupt. But yet, the church was still the church. And so, however you stand on a modern issue, there's going to be people on the wrong side of that issue that are God's own. And we all get stuff wrong. And that doesn't mean that I don't have differences of opinion about all sorts of things with other people. Hmm. What that means is that I am a human being, and that I, there are parts of me and parts of my mind and parts of my positions that will not surrender to Christ and maybe can't even understand him. But God still works through this mess. And that's why I have, you know, I think I've used this illustration in a sermon. We look back at Christians 200 years ago and say, how could you have owned slaves? It could be that 200 years from now, people will look back on us and say, how could you have burned petroleum just to go to the store to buy junk food? What a gross waste of Earth's resources to use this amazing thing called petroleum that can become plastics or fuel or fertilizer. It's just, petroleum is just magic stuff. And what do we use it for? We squander it. And so it could be that 200 years from now, we will look like the slave owners. Who knows? We're just people. So I, when it comes to debating things today, I have my perspectives and I'll make my argument as strong as I can. But when Jesus says, love your neighbor all the way up to and including your enemies, that includes our political enemies. That includes our slave owners. That includes the child molesters. That includes, who doesn't it include?
Yeah.
Only God gets to work that exclusion. So, but in our institutions, they have to mean something. So we do practice forms of exclusion down here. It's called definition. So I don't know. I don't know if that's an answer or not.
I think it's a good answer. And one of the questions that I ask myself is, you know, are you willing to follow the truth of Christ in the Christian paradigm, you know, in my estimation of reality? If you find out that what you think is true is wrong, right? If whatever my hard-held position might be, if I found out that I'm wrong, am I still willing to follow? Yeah. That's a hard question to answer, especially the stronger you feel about something.
Yeah.
That's tough. Well, I'm going to let you go, Paul. I appreciate the extra question. I do have two more things that I want to say, very short. One, I think you are Nick Fury. You accidentally said Nick Cage and somebody called you out on it in the comments. I'm setting the record straight. You are Nick Fury. And two, I'm looking forward to your second Tony Soprano, Dr. Melfi head session with, I can't remember her name either.
Davila.
Yeah, that was a good letting us peek into your counseling session. You know, a guy from Jersey with family from the old world and a psychologist. And so let's get episode two of the Soprano.
We'll call her Dr. Melfi. Guess that makes me Tony.
There you go. I didn't say it.
Oh, this was great, Jeff. This was wonderful. This was a lot of fun. And yeah. I really love the lobster con idea. That's cool. That's cool. And that's because
I think that would be so much fun to, and that's what the meetups are. But my meetups are just, you know, just this little group in Sacramento. And then sometimes people drive in.
Yeah.
But to spend, say, 3 days in a retreat setting in a small hotel where there's food and there's, you know, time to talk and there's sessions and then maybe, you know, little day trips out to go see some things. Yeah, that's a cool thing. But putting something like that together, because it's always hard to know who can show up.
Yeah.
Who will show up. I know some people who will.
Yeah.
But you know, it takes resources. Yep. You know, flying from other parts of the world.
Getting that time off work, all that kind of stuff. And
all those things
that we're bound by, you know, I know face to face is the best and in person is best. But one of the things I also said to Job was, you know, I don't see why we couldn't have more virtual meetups like we've kind of been organically having over the last week, where we could, you know, just start connecting with each other that watch these videos. And I know there's regulars in the comments. And so I don't see why we couldn't start reaching out to each other and opening up more of those unaired conversations, or maybe even if we all feel good about them, you know, airing them. I know Luke said, Paul, you need to be in them or nobody will watch. Well, it's just whoever wants to watch, we'll put them out there if people want to see it.
Yeah. Well, and I was thinking, you know, maybe start a sub channel or something with just these, and maybe just, you know, the hardcore will be there. But I think that's, I'd love to see that happen. I'm trying to figure out how to, this stuff is dicey to facilitate. Maybe the organic way it's happening now is the best way. I don't know, but.
It's not lost on me that your name is Paul and we've got all of these little communities starting to form across the world, across the known world.
Yeah. Well, you know, that very early on with John Vindonk, because John was a, you know, big piece of this, and Vindonk, he caught this vision right away. He starts pushing me and he's like, Paul, is this going to be church planting? And it's kind of like, well, it's sort of like it. I don't know what it is, but it's little communities are forming. And, you know, some of what I've seen here in Sacramento, once people start getting together and knowing each other, some of the things that the community does is very church-like. There's a reason churches have the shape that they have. And it's not simply, I mean, it's human. It's like these, you know, archetypal, you know, I didn't know anything about Jung or archetypes before any of this, but it's things will begin to reflect the patterns that are out there.
Yeah.
Why these stories all have this same shape. It's like, huh. So, and that maybe is an answer to Christ moving through things and people when we are simply unaware of it. So.
It's fun.
It is fun. We'll see where it goes.
All right. Well, until next time, if I can find another spot on the calendar, you see, I've got a list.
Well, what I did was I sort of blocked, because I needed to kind of take a break. And so I've got a vacation coming up, and I just kind of blocked out a little bit, and the slots will open up again.
That's
but fine. I needed to take a step back and to say, well, how can we manage this stuff? Because, you know, I don't want money to be the barrier, you know, so I know like Jordan and Jonathan have had, if you support me at this level, then because not everybody can support, and I don't want to choose everyone I talk to, or I never would have met you or Job or Jem or most of the people on the channel, or Mary. I talked with Mary today. Oh, we had fun. She is so much fun to talk to. She's such a delightful woman.
Yeah.
And so I don't want to be the filter. And I also don't want to set up a dynamic where people have to, in a sense, audition or compete. But I'm bound by time and space and energy and limitation. And so I don't know.
Yeah.
We'll not ever get it totally right, but we'll probably be playing around with some things.
All right. Well, as long as this version of it is available, I'm going to keep taking cracks at it.
All right.
Take care, Paul.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.